From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The second phase is Iraq. There is some indication, and I don't have the conclusions, but some of this anthrax may, and I emphasize may, have come from Iraq.
That's John McCain in 2001, like President Bush, building the case for war with Iraq. Well, last week, the FBI's prime suspect in the anthrax case, Bruce Ivins, died in an apparent suicide. What's the evidence against him? Then in a landmark decision, the FCC rules Comcast violated federal policy when it blocked users' access to the Internet.
Today, the commission tells Comcast to stop and to disclose to its subscribers and its customers how it is going to manage traffic on a going forward basis.
And there's something about Mary. How did a secret spy for the National Rifle Association masquerade as a leading activist in the gun control movement for more than a decade? Mother Jones pulls back the veil. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has acknowledged it has drastically underestimated the number of people becoming infected with AIDS in the United States. The CDC had been reporting 40,000 people got infected each year, but now the agency estimates the figure is 56,000, a 40% increase. CDC officials said the higher infection rates were discovered after using the agency's new blood test technology. The Wall Street Journal reports the CDC knew about the increased number of cases since last year, but waited to make the announcement until the opening of the International AIDS Conference in Mexico. AIDS activists are now calling for increased federal funding for AIDS prevention programs. Since 2002, the CDC's prevention budget has shrunk by 19% when adjusted for inflation. In Mexico, Margaret Chan, the Director General of the World Health Organization, described AIDS as the most challenging and probably the most demanding infectious disease humanity has ever had to face.
The epidemic is far from over. Let me repeat, the epidemic is far from over, and we are going to be in this for the long haul. First and foremost, we must do a much better job of prevention. This is the only way to get ahead and ensure an adequate long-term response.
On Saturday, thousands of people marched through the streets of Mexico City to demand equal rights for gays and lesbians and an end to discrimination against people who are HIV positive. Marchers included Venezuelan gay rights activist Edgar Carrasco.
Homophobia is a societal sickness which impedes development, limits expression, and human rights. Such as the hatred for HIV/AIDS, that public health policy has been significantly slowed.
16 Chinese police officers have died after gunmen attacked a police station in China's northwestern Xinjiang province. The attack comes just 4 days before the start of the Beijing Olympics. Human rights activists say they fear the attack will prompt Chinese authorities to severely crack down on members of the ethnic Muslim Uyghur population in Xinjiang province. The New York Times reports the evidence amassed by FBI investigators against Dr. Bruce Ivins, connecting him to the 2001 anthrax attacks, is largely circumstantial. Ivins is the Army scientist who killed himself last week after learning he was likely to be charged in the anthrax letter attack that killed 5 people. Meanwhile, the New York Daily News reports in the immediate aftermath of the 2001 anthrax attacks, White House officials repeatedly pressed FBI Director Robert Mueller to prove it was a second wave assault by al-Qaeda. A retired FBI official told the paper, quote, they really wanted to blame somebody in the Middle East. We'll have more on the anthrax story after headlines. The Federal Communications Commission has ruled cable giant Comcast violated federal policy when it blocked internet traffic for some subscribers. The FCC concluded Comcast monitored the content of its customers' internet connections and selectively blocked users of the peer-to-peer program BitTorrent. The commission's ruling is being viewed as a landmark defense of net neutrality. We'll have more on the ruling later in the broadcast. Senator Barack Obama has dropped his blanket opposition to offshore oil drilling after weeks of criticism from his Republican rival John McCain. Obama said he would be willing to expand some offshore oil drilling if it meant winning approval for a broader bipartisan energy bill to make the country more energy independent. Obama told the Palm Beach Post, quote, I don't want to be so rigid that we can't get something done. Senator John McCain has suggested adopting tactics used in Iraq to combat urban crime here at home. McCain made the comment while he spoke before the National Urban League.
Some of those tactics, very frankly, you mentioned the war in Iraq, are somewhat like that we use in the military. You go into neighborhoods, you clamp down, you provide a secure environment for the people that live there, and you make sure that the known criminals are kept under control, and you provide them with a stable environment, and then they cooperate with law enforcement.
The New York Times reports U.S. hospitals are increasingly deporting seriously injured or ill immigrants who cannot find nursing homes willing to accept them without insurance. The hospitals often conduct the deportations on their own without assistance from U.S. immigration authorities. Some immigrant rights advocates describe the procedure as a kind of international patient dumping. Dr. Stephen Larson of the University of Pennsylvania said, quote, "Repatriation is pretty much a death sentence in some of these cases. I've seen patients bundled onto the plane and out of the country, and once that person is out of sight, he's out of mind." At least one private company, MexCare, can be hired to handle deportations for hospitals. The Wall Street Journal reports Walmart has been warning its managers that an Obama victory in the fall would lead to unionization at Walmart stores. In recent weeks, thousands of Walmart store managers and department heads have been summoned to mandatory meetings discussing the downsides of unionization. The Journal reports the Walmart human resources managers who run the meetings don't specifically tell attendees how to vote in November's election, but make it clear that voting for Obama would be tantamount to inviting unions in. In economic news, the nation's official unemployment rate has risen to a four-year high of 5.7% after 51,000 workers lost their jobs in July. So far this year, the U.S. economy has lost over 460,000 jobs. The unemployment rate for teenagers is now just over 20%. Meanwhile, General Motors has reported it lost over $15 billion during the second quarter, and another bank has been forced to close. First Priority Bank of Florida is the eighth bank to fail this year. In legal news, the judge overseeing the criminal cases of some of the Gina 6 defendants has been removed from the case. The impartiality of Judge J.P. Mauffre had been questioned after he described the teenage defendants as, quote, a violent bunch and, quote, troublemakers. An Egyptian judge has convicted in absentia the prominent human rights activist Saad Eddin Ibrahim to 2 years in prison for, quote, tarnishing Egypt's reputation. Ibrahim is a longtime critic of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Ibrahim has lived in self-exile since last year. Ibrahim has also criticized the United States for funneling billions of dollars in foreign aid to Mubarak's government despite Egypt's human rights record. The Nobel Prize-winning Russian writer and dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn has died at the age of 89. In 1945, Solzhenitsyn was sentenced to 8 years in jail for criticizing Soviet leader Joseph Stalin. He later wrote about the prison conditions under Stalin in his famous book, The Gulag Archipelago. In 1970, Solzhenitsyn was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. 4 years later, he was stripped of his Soviet citizenship and forced into exile. After two decades in exile, he returned to Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union, but he was deeply critical of the new Russia.
What we have today could in no way be described as a democracy. Today we have an oligarchy, power limited to a closed circle.
And finally, Senator Barack Obama was confronted Friday by a group of black activists during a town hall meeting in St. Petersburg, Florida. Three men from the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement raised a banner reading, "What about the black community, Obama?" After the activists tried to disrupt the town hall meeting, Obama took a question from one of them, Diop Olugbala.
The question is, in the face of the numerous attacks that are made against the African community or the black community by the same U.S. government that you aspire to lead, and we're talking about attacks like the subprime mortgage that you spoke of, that wasn't just a general, ambiguous kind of phenomenon, but a phenomenon that targeted the African community and Latino community, attacks like the killing of Sean Bell by the New York Police Department, and Javon Dawson right here in St. Petersburg by the St. Pete Police. and the Gina 6 and Hurricane Katrina, and the list goes on. In the face of all these attacks that are clearly being made on the African community, why is it that you have not had the ability to not one time speak to the interests and even speak on behalf of the oppressed and exploited African community or black community in this country?
Barack Obama responded by saying he has spoken out about every issue raised.
I have repeatedly said that many of the predatory loans that were made in the mortgage system did target African-American and Latino communities. I've said that repeatedly. Number two, Gina 6. I was the first candidate to get out there and say this is wrong, there's an injustice that's been done, and we need to change it. That's number two. When Sean Bell got shot, I put out a statement immediately saying this is a problem. Don't start shouting back. I'm just answering your question.
Barack Obama at a town hall meeting in Florida. He turns 47 years old today. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, very happy to be back. And congratulations to my colleagues who did such a fantastic job last week, to Sharif Abdelkaddous and Anjali Kamat and Juan Gonzalez. Well, the FBI's prime suspect in the October 2001 anthrax letters case died last week in an apparent suicide. Bruce Ivins was an elite government scientist at the Biodefense Research Lab at Fort Detrick, Maryland. He was among the nation's top experts on the military use of anthrax. Ivins reportedly died soon after learning the Justice Department was about to file criminal charges against him for the 2001 anthrax attacks that killed five people and sickened 17 others, crippling the National Mail Service. He had been part of a team that helped the government investigate the attacks and won the Pentagon's highest civilian award in 2003. Many of his colleagues are convinced Ivins was innocent and claim he lacked the motive and the means to develop the fine powder used in the letter scare. They're also skeptical of the FBI's investigation, one of the largest in U.S. history, given its false starts over the past 7 years. The investigation initially focused on Stephen Hatfield, the one-time colleague of Bruce Ivins. But this June, the Justice Department settled with Hatfield for $5.82 million. Whether Ivins was guilty or not, the case also raises key questions about how the anthrax scare was initially linked to Islamic terrorists in Iraq. In a piece for Salon.com, attorney and author Glenn Greenwald writes, repeated claims by the mainstream media linking the attacks to Saddam Hussein helped shape American perceptions about Iraq in the lead-up to the invasion. Glenn Greenwald joins us now by telephone from Brazil. We're also joined on the phone by Dr. Meryl Nass. She's in Maine. She's an expert on anthrax and knew Bruce Ivins. On her blog, anthraxvaccine.blogspot.com, she writes she believes Ivins was probably innocent. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Glenn Greenwald, let's begin with you. When you heard about Bruce Ivins being the key suspect, about to be indicted, apparently, we all learned this after his suicide. Can you talk about your reaction?
It's hard to have any reaction to anything that the government and the FBI say about the anthrax investigation other than extreme skepticism in light of the fact that everything that they've done and said over the past 7 years, by all accounts, has been either completely inept or worse, deliberately misguided away from the true source of the anthrax. And so all of these news accounts over the past several days that have suggested that Bruce Ivins is the person behind the anthrax attacks are lacking one critical ingredient, and that any evidence whatsoever that those claims are true. And the one thing that I would underscore is, as you said in your introductory remarks, the LA Times, when they reported this story originally, said that Ivins was about to be indicted, trying to suggest that it was literally imminent, like a day or two away. And yet a New York Times story this morning spoke with various investigators at the FBI who have now backtracked significantly on that claim. And they're saying that all of the evidence that they have against Ivins is, quote, entirely circumstantial, and that the grand jury intended to hear evidence for at least several more weeks before deciding whether or not to indict him. So there's all sorts of mystifying questions that have plagued this case from the start, and there's even more now in light of this recent event, and what we need is a real public hearing of all these facts.
I want to turn to Senator McCain and his comments soon after September 11th. He was on the David Letterman show. It was October 18th, 2001, and he brought up Iraq as a possible, quote, second phase of the war in Afghanistan. He said the anthrax may have come from Iraq.
How are things going in Afghanistan now?
I think we're doing fine. I think we've removed what little anti-aircraft capability they have. These C-130 gunships are pretty awesome weapons of war, and I believe that the Taliban will be removed. I think we'll do fine. The second phase, if I could just make it very quickly, the second phase is Iraq. There is some indication, and I don't have the conclusions, but some of this anthrax may, and I emphasize may, have come from Iraq.
Oh, is that right?
If that may be the case, then that's when some tough decisions are going to have to be made, too.
President Bush would echo what McCain had to say, linking Iraq to anthrax, in his 2002 State of the Union address just a few months later. This is an excerpt.
Iraq continues to flaunt its hostility toward America and to support terror. The Iraqi regime has plotted to develop anthrax and nerve gas and nuclear weapons for over a decade. This is a regime that has already used poison gas to murder thousands of its own citizens, leaving the bodies of mothers huddled over their dead children. This is a regime that agreed to international inspections, then kicked out the inspectors. This is a regime that has something to hide from the civilized world.
That was President Bush in 2002. And now the New York Daily News is reporting in the immediate aftermath of the 2001 anthrax attacks, White House officials repeatedly pressed FBI Director Robert Mueller to prove it was a second wave assault by al-Qaeda. So, Glenn Greenwald, take us from the point of the attacks to the direction the investigation took from the government and this information to Stephen Hatfill.
Well, clearly the focus in the initial phases was on trying to link the anthrax attacks to Islamic terrorism and as a second stage of the 9/11 attacks. And in fact, the anthrax attacker or attackers clearly had the same goal in mind. I mean, the letters that accompany the anthrax, a lot of people have forgotten, were dated 9/11/01, and they said things like, we have anthrax, prepare to die, death to America, death to Israel, Allah is great. And so there was a clear attempt on the part of the attackers themselves to link the attack to Islamic radicalism. And then all sorts of sources inside of the government were claiming that there was evidence found at the Fort Detrick lab, where the government now says the attacks came from, that also linked the attacks to Iraq. There was one particularly influential story from ABC News and Brian Ross, where for days and days on Peter Jennings and other shows, they claimed that they were told by many sources inside the government that tests had found the presence of something called bentonite, which is the hallmark, they said, of the Iraqi biological weapons program. It turned out that claim was totally false. There never was any bentonite found in the anthrax. Everybody now agrees. And yet, as you showed from the clip from John McCain, there was clips from Joe Lieberman several days later on Meet the Press. There was a concerted effort to try and link the anthrax in the public mind to Saddam Hussein and to Iraq specifically and Islamic radicalism more generally. The FBI ultimately, through their tests, decided that all of the evidence was actually pointing to U.S. government facilities and U.S. government and U.S. Army research labs of the type where Bruce Ivins and Stephen Hatfill worked at Fort Detrick. And so they were aware from the start that it was almost certainly a domestic source, and yet all kinds of factions within the government and out tried continuously to depict it as something that was likely coming from Iraq, and they continued to do that for several years, even when it was clearly established that it was almost certainly a domestic source.
We're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Dr. Merrill Nass, who is an anthrax expert, physician, and writer, blogs at anthraxvaccine.blogspot.com, and new Bruce Ivins, the man who committed suicide last week. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our discussion in this aftermath of the apparent suicide of Bruce Ivins, the man who now the government says was moving in on, perhaps, to indict, holding him responsible for the anthrax attacks of 2001. He committed suicide right after being informed that he was the prime suspect in the investigation. Our guests are Glenn Greenwald, constitutional law attorney and blogger for Salon.com. His latest book is The Great American Hypocrites, Toppling the Big Myths of Republican Politics. And Dr. Merrill Nass joins us now from Maine, who blogs at anthraxvaccine.blogspot.com. Did you know Bruce Ivins, Dr. Nass? Dr. Nass?
Yes.
Did you know Bruce Ivins?
Yes, I knew him.
Tell us about who he was.
He was a very pleasant, sort of Midwestern scientist, salt of the earth kind of guy, maybe a little bit nervous. He did good work. I was able to rely on the quality of his work in all the many papers that he published on anthrax vaccine. And he was a generous scientist in that he was always willing to discuss work that I was doing and provide me with papers or information about that work.
Were you surprised when you heard the government was targeting him?
Yes, I was completely shocked, and of course I found that out after he'd committed suicide. He'd be the last person I would have suspected. Not that I'm any expert, but I have been told that there is no forensic personality for a crime like this that's been defined. So I guess it's possible that he did it, but I absolutely cannot come up with a motive with access and with the complicated things that would need to be done if he were a loner performing such an act. And I am struck by the fact that there were at least two earlier people who, in my view, appeared to have been set up as possible patsies for the letter attacks, and Hatfill being one and Ayad Assad being another. The week the letters were sent, a letter was sent to Quantico implicating Assad, and the Quantico letter actually arrived before the anthrax letters, but it seemed that there was a definite intent to link Assad. So,
explain who Assad was.
Assad was an Egyptian scientist who previously had worked at Fort Detrick. He was not an anthrax scientist, neither was Hatfill. And he had had a difficult time at Fort Detrick. There were a number of other scientists who used to make fun of him, Laura Rosen outlined all this in an article in Salon.com back about 5 or 6 years ago. As a result, he left. He filed, an age discrimination suit against Fort Detrick. And he was called in for questioning after this letter appeared. So it looked like somebody was trying to finger Assad. And then later, there were a lot of odd coincidences with respect to Stephen Hatfill and his travels and his past history and living in Rhodesia that had correspondence with features of the anthrax attack. So he had lived in Harare, which had a suburb named Greendale, and there were these letters postmarked Greendale, not postmarked, but Greendale was the return address. So there were it seemed that somebody who knew a bit about Hatfill's life also had attempted to implicate him in the letter. So now we have Ivins, and the Justice Department has failed to provide to the public any shred of evidence that really would link Ivins in any kind of definitive way to this crime. This morning we're being told that there is forensic scientific evidence to show that the strain in the letters was a strain that came from his lab. But, you know, the old saw in bioterrorism is that, of course, you select your agent from so that it will make somebody else look guilty. So somebody else could have gotten a strain from his lab in order to cast aspersions on Ivins. The fact that it was found in his lab really means nothing. I mean, a smart scientist who is going to create an attack like this is clearly not going to choose anthrax, so it's going to lead right back to his own lab. So I think that no matter how fancy the forensics gets, you're not going to get an answer there. And if that is the basis for the charges against Ivins, it is, in my mind, very weak.
I wanted to go back to an interview that I did in July of 2003 with Patrick Claussen, the friend and former spokesperson for Stephen Hatfill. I asked Claussen about the FBI investigation that named Hatfill as a, quote, person of interest in the anthrax case.
The problem that Steve Hatfill has is that his life is a living nightmare right now. Every place he goes, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, he is followed by squads of FBI agents. Just last week, Steve and I went out to have some drinks and dinner, and as soon as I left his house, bam, I had 7 FBI cars following me all over Northwest Washington, D.C. Sometimes these agents swear at him, they flip him the finger. There's nothing surreptitious about this. This is not a surveillance. This is an open, in-your-face harassment campaign. Steve Hatfill is a poster boy for abuses of the Patriot Act.
That was Patrick Claussen, friend of Stephen Hatfill, who just a few weeks ago won more than $5.8 million from the U.S. government. Glenn Greenwald, can you talk about that campaign against Stephen Hatfill? There was very little attention about the fact he just won $6 million, and then the fingering of Bruce Ivins.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary. I mean, they basically destroyed his life and destroyed his reputation. And what was so amazing about that was that for years, what they did was investigators inside the Justice Department and the FBI continuously and systematically leaked to a whole slew of reporters all kinds of accusatory innuendo about Hatfill, information about his medical records, about things that they had found in his garbage cans, about parts of his personal life that they had obtained as a result of very widespread surveillance. And they absolutely tailed him in a way that was designed to make him in public appear as though he was clearly the guilty party. And then when he sued essentially everybody, the government and all of the journalists who had published all of this information, the journalists acted to protect the government in every way. I mean, they refused to disclose who it was who had fed them this information. And the court ultimately ended up ordering the journalists to disclose their sources so that Hatfill was on the verge of finding out who inside the Justice Department and the FBI had been disclosing all this information designed to make him look like the anthrax attacker, when, as the government ultimately through its actions, ended up conceding it by paying him millions of dollars and then by ultimately now charging or accusing Ivins of being the attacker. All of this information was untrue all along. And so the investigation was directed almost exclusively at someone who the government now says had nothing to do with the attacks, and they used the media along the way to publicly convict him and destroy his life. And the media not only cooperated enthusiastically, but continues to protect the people inside the government who did that. And of course, you see the same thing with the media doing that with regard to who inside the government tried to lie to the public by connecting the attacks to Iraq. And now Ivins is essentially being convicted in public as well through selected leaks from the government to the media that then prints it more or less uncritically. So the whole investigation has been a sham from the start. And even if you want to be as generous as possible in your interpretation, you would say that it's been filled from start to finish with pure ineptitude. And that's why I think a full-scale congressional investigation, or the kind of commission that was charged with investigating the 9/11 attacks with real subpoena power, is absolutely vital here to having the public believe that they've gotten even the basic facts about what occurred.
What about the court documents and tapes that reveal his therapist, Gene Dooley's, concerns to the FBI after receiving death threats from Ivins?
Well, I find that whole part of the story bizarre in so many ways. I mean, first of all, if you look at Bruce Ivins' history, he doesn't actually have a shred of a criminal record. By contrast, Gene Dooley, who is not actually a psychiatrist or a psychologist, she's actually a social worker who just recently graduated from school, and is the kind of social worker who does things like, you know, lead group therapy sessions and the like. She's hardly a credible or authoritative expert on someone's psychological state as she's being depicted. But she actually has a long history of being involved in various court proceedings. She was convicted in 2007 and then again in 2006 and again in 2007 of driving under the influence of alcohol. She's been on probation. She's still on probation, actually. She's had significant financial difficulties. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, while working with the FBI, she starts making some very extreme accusations about Bruce Ivins' history, about his psychological condition, that none of his coworkers or friends or people who know him confirm in any way, shape, or form. In fact, they vehemently contradict it. And so much of the media's depiction of Ivins as this kind of unstable, violent, threatening, psychotic is based on the claims of someone who, for a lot of different reasons, really isn't particularly credible. I mean, it may turn out that Ivins is guilty. It may turn out that what she said is true. But before anyone even forms an opinion about those issues, we ought to wait and see what the evidence really is. And so far, what the media has given us is extremely unconvincing.
Finally, Dr. Merrill Nass, there's been reports that the investigation will basically be finished by the end of the week, will wrap up, and there will be more information implicating Dr. Ivins.
You know, what I'm afraid of, Amy, is that we will hear a lot of fluff and that the investigation will, in fact, wrap up. And all the important information will be classified. We've already gotten a tremendous amount of misinformation from unidentified government spokesperson, and that is not just this weekend, but going back to the initial release of the letters, there has been a tremendous amount of innuendo and information put forward that has never been backed up and never been attributed to anybody. And I fear that because a variety of the information that may be used to convict Bruce Ivins after his death is going to be classified, or perhaps we will be given false information, that it will become impossible to defend him and impossible to really make sense of the entire letters case. And I'm very concerned about the whole concept of having significant amount of information in a criminal case that is classified or that that only the Justice Department has access to, and whether that precludes justice for people who are ensnared in those cases.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us. Dr. Merrill Nass, anthrax expert, physician, writer, writes at anthraxvaccine.blogspot.com. And Glenn Greenwald, speaking to us from Brazil, constitutional law attorney, blogger for Salon.com. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we move now to another explosive story. This about the infiltration of gun control groups by a secret spy for the National Rifle Association. For more than a decade, Mary McFate was a prominent gun control activist involved in almost every single national gun control organization. She served on their boards, attended strategy meetings, organized the Million Mom March in 2000, lobbied Washington to prevent gun violence. Mary Lou Sapone was a freelance spy who worked for the National Rifle Association. She covertly infiltrated gun control groups as well as environmental and animal rights groups while working as an operative for private security firms hired by corporations. A Mother Jones investigation revealed last week that Mary McFate and Mary Lou Sapone are the same person. The article's called There's Something About Mary, Unmasking a Gun Lobby Mole. The revelations about Mary McFate's double life have shocked the gun control community who trusted her for years. I'm joined now here in the Firehouse studio by Barbara Holt, the executive director of States United to Prevent Gun Violence. James Ridgway, a senior Washington correspondent for Mother Jones magazine. He's been investigating the spying activities of Mary Lou Sapone for months and helped break this story. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome both to Democracy Now! Jim Ridgway, how did you hear about this? How did you unmask this mole?
Well, I had a tip, basically. And the way I did it was I had done previous stories about a company called BBI, and that was an investigations company down in Easton, Maryland. And one of the investor in BBI came to the conclusion that he was being defrauded. So he went into BBI and he took out all the records and he put them in a storehouse. And these records then reveal the internal workings of this organization, of this detective company. So what I did was I, since I knew that Mary Lou Sapone had been involved in an environmental case working for BBI in Louisiana, I went down and I started looking for inside the ledgers of this BBI for the NRA to see if they were a client. And it turned out they were a client. So then the question was, did this have anything to do with Mary Lou Sapone? And so I remembered there was a suit brought by the owner of this company, the guy that thought he was defrauded. And so I asked him to go through a couple of depositions by key people in BBI in this suit and see whether there was any reference to Mary Lou Sapone. And sure enough, he found the reference. And the reference, basically, there are several references. And in one case, it was clear that, of course, that Mary Lou Sapone worked for BBI. In another case, it was in another section, it was clear that Mary Lou Sapone was a subcontractor or associated with the NRA. And then it was made clear that Mary Lou Sapone actually introduced the NRA to BBI. So I thought that was pretty interesting. So then my colleagues, David Korn and Dan Shulman and I, we continued to work on this and we started talking to the gun groups and we put two and two together. And finally, David Korn, in a rash move, picked up the telephone. We'd found that the numbers of Mary Lou Sapone and Mary McFate were the same. So we called the number in Sarasota, Florida. A woman answered and he said, "Is this Mary Lou Sapone?" The woman said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, this is David Korn from Mother Jones Magazine." Bang, that was it. And so we proceeded from there.
We're also joined by Barbara Holt, Executive Director of States United to Prevent Gun Violence. Mary was your lobbyist.
Yes, not immediately. I first met Mary, I was trying to remember, a number of years ago back in the movement, and she was always very active, and she was active in almost every single organization. And in 2005, it's funny, I, I volunteered to be the executive director of States United to Prevent Gun Violence because this is a trade association of all the state organizations around the country that work on gun violence prevention. And they're all very small groups, and so their trade association doesn't have much money, and but still working hard on this issue. And Mary was there as a sort of an alternate representative from a couple of the states, and she was very involved and very interested in everything that was going on. She also frequently went to Washington because she was active in the Million Moms. She, on her own, would go and visit members of Congress about the various issues around gun violence prevention. And one day we were talking, and we said, well, you know, maybe if you're going all the time to Congress, you would like to go for some of our states that don't have the time or money to send somebody to D.C. And she said she'd be interested in doing that. So in 2006, I just looked it up. We in the summer, we took a board vote authorizing her to lobby for those state organizations that wanted her as their lobbyist. They had to agree to it. They had to talk to her about it. And so at that point, she did start doing some lobbying for us.
And she was known to you as Mary McFate.
She was known to us as Mary McFate.
Her maiden name.
Yeah, yeah. I think that the thing that's really gotten everybody about this is many of our groups have victims of gun violence in them. In some cases, the executive director of the group is a victim of gun violence. And they've all known Mary for a long time, and they've told her their stories and shared their experiences and pain with her. And so particularly to victims of gun violence, this is very devastating to have this happen, to find out that this person that you thought you were talking to and was working with you is reportedly working for the other side. It's not like finding out that somebody's spying on a corporation. It's finding out that somebody's spying on victims of gun violence. So it's kind of like a double victimization, almost.
Her level of involvement with not one, not two, but many of the groups, almost all of them, the leading groups against gun violence, we'll talk about after break. Our guests are Barbara Holt, Executive Director of States United to Prevent Gun Violence, Mary McFate was their lobbyist in Washington, and James Ridgway, who exposed this story with David Corn in the Mother Jones magazine. Stay with us. Stages of Awakening here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Our guests are Barbara Holt, Executive Director of States United to Prevent Gun Violence. Mary McFate was their lobbyist in Washington. It's a well-known anti-gun group, a coalition of the different anti-gun violence groups. And Jim Ridgway, Senior Washington Correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. Jim Ridgway, explain the number of groups that Mary McFate, her real name, Mary Lou Sapone, worked her way through over this last decade?
Well, as you just heard, I mean, there was a whole network of groups, state groups, and then there was the Brady Campaign, which is pretty well known in Washington. And originally, I sort of confirmed that Mary McFate was into this by looking up a group called Ceasefire in Pennsylvania. Mary McFate, when she was Mary Lou Sapone, was running this Louisiana operation out of Pennsylvania. So there's actually, it's probably unknown how many groups she was involved with, but I mean, we talked to a good number of people. and her visibility was pretty widespread. But let me just point out also that in one of her emails that I discovered, she said that this was kind of like a family operation, that her overall business was like a family operation. And she had a son named Sean, who was a military person who was pretty well known, and that he was part of it, and that a daughter-in-law named Montgomery McFate, who's a well-known anthropologist, was also there. And we found a bill from a company run by Mary Lou McFate called Strategic Solutions to BBI, that's the detective company, from Montgomery McFate. And we were told, and the records prove, that Montgomery McFate also worked as a staff member of Handgun Inc. So neither Montgomery McFate nor Sean McFate would talk to us. But there is the whole question of her family, of her immediate family.
Barbara Hull. Yes. The involvement in the different groups, and also your experience once with, on the one hand, you thought she was extremely well off, would talk about when she dropped out of sight being on cruises, and on the other hand, well, wanting to save money on a phone call.
Right. Okay. Well, I think nobody ever doubted, as time went on, Mary's dedication to the cause, because she was involved in so many things. In some way, she was like me. I'm a volunteer, too. I'm lucky to have the time to do this. But she was involved in practically every group. She started out with the Pennsylvanians Against Handgun Violence, which is now a group that no longer exists, that was in Pittsburgh, apparently. She lived in Grove City, Pennsylvania, and got involved with that group. Then she got involved with the Million Mom March in 2000. From the Million Mom March, she got involved in Ceasefire PA, which was a new group formed in Pennsylvania after the march by some of the moms from Pennsylvania. Through her state group, she was involved in States United to Prevent Gun Violence. Then recently, she's also was involved with Freedom States Alliance, which is another coalition of state groups that was formed in the Midwest. And she's actually a board member of both Freedom States Alliance and Ceasefire PA, was a board member. She was a person who, like, had the ability to go everywhere. She went to all kinds of conferences. She always went to the NRA conference. She went to any demonstrations people were putting on, no matter where they were. So she was really widely traveled. About 3 weeks ago, I was with her at the Small Arms Conference at the UN. She is a member of IANSA, which is the International Action Network Against Small Arms. So she was really involved in the complete picture. And sometimes, you know, afterwards, you know, we didn't think about it. We thought of her as really a dedicated volunteer, and I think people have been very upset by that because they think that they were talking to someone, and now they're realizing maybe they were talking to someone who was being dishonest with them.
Looking
the whole time.
Looking back, the odd encounters, like her dropping in at New Yorkers Against Gun Violence?
Well, actually, we realized the other day the oddest encounter with New Yorkers Against Gun Violence was not asking to come and use the telephone. About a year and a half ago, she came to the annual meeting of New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Now, we're not a large group. We're a small, you know, advocacy group. And we have an annual meeting once a year, and Mary is not from New York. So it's sort of a surprise. But she said she was up here. I think she said she was in New York because she was going to go to plays. And when we talked about that meeting, we realized that the speaker at the meeting was somebody from the law department of the city of New York. And he was speaking about the cases against the gun dealers down in the South. So it was funny that she should turn up for that particular meeting.
You also have a side interesting story, Jim Ridgway, in your piece, something about Mary, about her daughter and son-in-law, Sean and Montgomery Sapone, better known as Sean and Montgomery McFate, a successful Washington couple, you write, whose current bios make no mention of any past intelligence gathering or opposition research work. Sean, currently the program director of the National Security Initiative at the Bipartisan Policy Center. You say that Montgomery made a name for herself as one of the primary architects of the U.S. military's Human Terrain Program, which teams social scientists with military units in Iraq and Afghanistan to help soldiers better understand the local culture. Very controversial in the American Anthropological Association.
Well, yes, Ms. McFate has, you know, she's very widely known. I think she's been on Charlie Rose and various programs. So her, you know, her visibility on that issue is very well known. But I wanted to just stress a couple of things, because I know people will say that it's reported that Mary McFate was connected to the NRA. I personally have seen the billings from BBI, the detective company, to a Patrick O'Malley, who is a second-in-command to Jim Baker, or was second-in-command to Jim Baker, two key officials of the NRA. I have seen transactional documents that show that this relationship between Mary McFate and Patrick O'Malley, it was ongoing in 2007 and in 2008. So this article was written not on the basis of some, you know, inside rumor or some, you know, wild speculation, but is based entirely on court records and on factual material, which we have examined.
How widespread is this kind of corporate espionage, where corporations infiltrate citizen groups?
Well, I think it's quite widespread. It's widespread in the environmental movement, and the method that's used seems to be the same. Excuse me. And that is that the corporation will hire a PR firm, which in turn, on its own, or it will hire then one of these detective companies, and they then will get what's called a cutout. Mary Lou Sapone was a cutout. Then the cutout hires the moles, and there's usually more than one mole. So in this gun thing, I would assume, I would guess, that Mary Lou Sapone was certainly not the only person. And in the environmental situation, she actually appeared herself, but there were there's at least one other mole. So my guess is
the name of that mole.
Pardon?
Do you know the name of that mole? At least one other mole.
I know. These people all have different aliases, so I'm not going to say the name. I know who it is, but it has been. I think the mole has been outlined and, you know, revealed in maybe local papers, but there probably are two, maybe three moles in Louisiana. So, and who operated under aliases. And, of course, there was surveillance by BBI in Louisiana by former Secret Service agent. So, but what I'm saying is that in this case of the gun thing, it seems to me, or I guess, I suppose, that the NRA, being a pretty big and well-funded organization, wouldn't put all its money in one person. So there are probably, I would guess, more people involved in all this.
One last question to Barbara Holt. Your groups must be doing a lot of soul-searching right now, or figuring out what to do.
Yes, I think they are. But I think one of the things that this has done, which is probably a good benefit, it's brought people together. The groups are all talking together about what their legal options might be.
What are they?
I'm not a lawyer, so I would have difficulty really explaining them, except to look into whether there's some civil actions they could take or any criminal actions, because she was a board member of two organizations, serving on the board, in which you have a responsibility toward the board and toward the goals of the organization. So that's it. And the question of what kind of lobbying she might have done, all those are issues we're looking into. I think as a group, we're also looking into you know, how do we vet people? I mean, when you're in a volunteer organizations that don't have a lot of money, when somebody comes along and they look like they really believe in your cause, you have a tendency to welcome them in. On the other hand, we don't want to get what we don't want to happen from this is to get so paranoid you're suspicious of everybody. Because the one difference, I think, between the people that work for gun violence prevention and the people who work on the other side is that we really are very open. We don't have a lot of secrets. We don't play dirty tricks on people. You know, actually, if you wanted to find out what we were doing, you could probably look at our websites and pretty much find it out. There aren't a lot of secrets. So we don't want to get into another mold. We want to stay true to our values and be very but pursue this and not let this happen to us again.
Barbara Holt, thanks for being with us. Executive Director of States United to Prevent Gun Violence, and Jim Ridgway, part of the team from Mother Jones Magazine, who wrote the piece, There's Something About Mary, Unmasking a Gun Lobby Mole. This is Democracy Now! As we move to our last segment, a landmark decision. The Federal Communications Commission's ruled cable giant Comcast violated federal policy when it blocked internet traffic for some subscribers and ordered the company to change the way it manages its network. In a 3-2 vote, the FCC approved an enforcement order that would require Comcast to stop blocking traffic and publicly disclose its methods for interfering with internet access. FCC Chair Kevin Martin announced the ruling on Friday.
Some broadband subscribers complained to the commission that Comcast was blocking and delaying their internet traffic. Our investigations and the findings of several widely respected engineers confirmed their complaints. Comcast was delaying subscribers' downloads and was blocking their uploads. It was doing so 24/7, regardless of the amount of congestion on the network or how small the file might actually be. And even worse, Comcast was hiding that fact by making affected users think that there was a problem with their internet connection or their application. Today, the commission tells Comcast to stop and to disclose to its subscribers and its customers how it is going to manage traffic on a going forward basis.
Craig Aaron is Communications Director for Free Press, joining us from Washington. How did this come about, Craig Aaron?
Well, this ruling that happened on Friday, which is really a landmark, a historic precedent, was the result of an incredible grassroots movement to draw attention to these issues of an open internet. It actually all started because there was one network engineer out in Oregon, an enthusiast of turn-of-the-century barbershop quartet music, who was trying to share his music, legal content, mind you, one night and found he was being blocked. He got suspicious. He started sounding the alarm. Eventually, the Associated Press and the Electronic Frontier Foundation launched their own independent investigations, all concluding that Comcast was secretly blocking internet traffic. My group, Free Press, along with our allies at Public Knowledge and a group of legal scholars, filed a formal complaint with the FCC and sorry about that, Amy. Filed a formal complaint with the FCC, and that started their investigation, which culminated Friday with a vote, a really historic vote, because it's the first time that the FCC has taken action to protect our right to go on the internet, to do whatever we want, whenever we want, without blocking or discrimination.
Tests by the Associated Press and others showed Comcast actively interferes with attempts by some subscribers to share files online by sending fake signals that cut off the connection between them. Can you explain what BitTorrent is? Democracy Now! Actually goes out on BitTorrent as well, and how this was the key here.
Sure. Well, BitTorrent is a file-sharing program, and the way it works is that it pulls small bits of information from a lot of different computers to easily download large files, large video files, large audio files, other kind of files. Again, legal content allows people to share it without, you know, very quickly. That's the advantage of BitTorrent. What Comcast did, essentially, is it impersonated its own customers. It was as if I was having a phone conversation with you. All of a sudden, somebody comes on the line, sounds just like me, says, I have to hang up right now and don't ever call me again. That was sort of the user experience if you were being blocked by Comcast in this situation. And it goes against all the established standards, all the principles laid out by the FCC that prohibit this kind of secret blocking. And this was the first real test of whether the FCC would actually do something about it. And it's refreshing that they actually did do something about it in this case. I feel like every time I come on the show, it's to talk about something bad that the FCC's done. In this case, we can talk about something good the FCC's done in a bipartisan manner and as a result of really unprecedented public involvement in this process.
Craig Aaron, I want to thank you for being with us, spokesperson for Free Press, speaking to us from Washington, D.C., and that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burk, Shrufo Dokaduce, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Honey Masood, Robbie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Peter Curries, our engineers. If you'd like a copy of today's broadcast, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. There are our transcripts as well as video and audio podcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.